Hello, six pack of confidence. Been so many nights since we first met. Glad to see you brought all your friends for another night of Plastic Cup Politics.
How's it going, everybody? Thanks for pressing play on a new episode of Plastic Cup Politics Podcast. Even tried a new intro, didn't like it, went back to the old one. This is the new, kinder, gentler, more sporadic Plastic Cup Politics podcast. So really what the important thing is if you hear this and you enjoy this, you need to hit the subscribe. However you're listening to this, I'm telling you right off the bat, subscribe. Because we don't really know when these are coming out. They're just coming out when we have time and there's something important like World War III, and then we decided we should probably do a podcast about it. So that's what we're doing right here at Plastic Cup Pod. It's a drinking and politics podcast based out of Arizona. I'm your host, Mark LaRue. He is Dr. Sean Hayes. That's with a PhD in political science, even though he is a information securities engineer with a bunch of weird letters after his name at this point in time. But he still has that political science degree, and that's what we use to poke him with. And we can just get right to the drinking part of this, where I say, hey, man, we've been off the air. How was your holiday? Anything happened in the last couple weeks other than the shit that we're going to talk about?
Yeah. No, my holiday was excellent. It was fantastic. So good, I didn't want to return to work. but I did, which was interesting in and of itself, because the morning I came back to work after the holiday was the morning that the news broke about the assassination of Soleimani. And so the first part of my day was spent setting everything on high alert.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But we'll come back to that. I'm not drinking tonight. I'm smoking my mind expansion and mood improvement device. This is... going old school, Durban Poison, man, by Timeless.
Are you ready to hear the most hippie drink possible?
Let's hear it.
Okay. I am drinking. Okay, this part isn't hippie. This part is just awesome. If you've not had the Screwball Whiskey, I do believe I would put whiskey in quotation marks in Screwball Whiskey. It is a peanut butter whiskey, and it's delicious. I only put the quotations because it's 70% alcohol, or sorry, 70 proof. 70 yeah. proof, 35%. I think if you're going to be whiskey, you have to be 80 proof. But so that, and then one of my lovely fiance's coworkers, Marie, who would hate this podcast, she made homemade Kahlua. So peanut butter whiskey, Kahlua, and then Oatly extra creamy oat milk. It is so goddamn good. It is a delicious cocktail.
Filthy fucking hippie.
I know, right? Homemade Kahlua and oat milk.
Oh, next you're going to show up with beads in that magnificent beard of yours.
Yeah, I think that my days at the Hippie Emporium have been numbered, but I'll have to go talk to Hippie Emporium in Cottonwood. Still an awesome place if you're looking for things that smell. And let's go ahead and we can talk about World War III. When we've talked previously, when a U.S. drone was shot down and then Trump was going to bomb the shit out of him, and then he decided that he didn't want to kill a bunch of people just because an unmanned drone went down. Things have escalated to the point where we bombed a high-value target in the Iranian military inside of Kuwait. And now everybody over there Iraq. Inside of Iraq. Good call. So everybody seems to be pretty upset. But remember Kuwait, because I have a thing that we might get back to.
Yeah. Got it.
And so now you can expand on my very limited description of what went on with the PhD shit.
So I think it's important for this particular event to step back just a tiny bit and talk about who this Soleimani guy actually was. Back in 1953, we, meaning the United States and the United Kingdom, our Foreign intelligence services went into Iran and staged a coup and overthrew the democratically elected government and put in charge a guy named the Shah, Shah Mossadegh. And the Shah was our dude, right? And we used the Shah to sort of be the proxy U.S. policy arm in the Middle East. And the Shah was a really horrible, horrible, horrible fucking person. Who tortured and murdered his own people on a very large scale. And ultimately, in 1979, there was a Islamic revolution. So primarily religious forces revolted, overthrew the Shah, and stormed the U.S. embassy in Tehran, because everyone, including the Iranian people, knew who Shah Mossadegh worked for. And they captured 52 hostages, and they held those hostages until 1983, I think. 1983 or 84. But they held them for like 4 years total. And eventually, the Reagan administration negotiated with terrorists, which they swore they would never do, to secure the release of the 52 hostages in the embassy. So that sort of sets the stage for what comes next, right? So the US and Iran don't like each other and have not had normalized relations.
What was the thing that happened like with like Carter and like when Reagan won then?
Yeah, so that was actually that was also in 1979. That was immediately after the embassy was stormed. And the hostages were taken. Jimmy Carter ordered the extraction of the hostages. He sent in a team of special operations forces. I'm not going to do this story justice in terms of the facts. If I remember correctly, there was they got caught in a sandstorm or something, and some of the helicopters crashed, and some of the special operations forces were killed, and the whole thing was a huge fiasco that contributed in a significant way to Jimmy Carter's subsequent defeat by Ronald Reagan in the 1980 presidential election.
Boom. Now back to 1983 or four.
Something else happened. Something else significant happened right around the time that the hostages came home. A full-scale war erupted between Iran and Iraq. Iran and Iraq are neighbors. I'm not going to keep trying to do it. I sound silly doing the Iran and Iraq. That's not me. Anyway, Iran and Iraq went to war with each other. There had been tensions for quite some time, in part because Iraq was run principally by the Sunni minority, a group called the Baathists or the Baath Party, which was representative of the Sunni minority. The majority of Iraq is Shiite Muslim, which is the majority in Iran. So the Iranians went to war with the Iraqis, meaning, Ayatollah Khomeini, the original Ayatollah of Iran, went to war with Saddam Hussein. I don't know what is going on.
Dude, that was that ghost again. Dude, 100%.
Weird. They go to war, and it is a terrible war. Dude, and it may have actually started before 83, if I remember correctly. But anyway, they go to war. It's an awful war. It's been compared to the same kind of carnage that we saw at like the Somme in World War One, which was just fields of butchery, people marching at each other through fixed artillery fire and landmines and just madness. And that is where Major General Qasem Soleimani first comes on the scene and becomes a war hero, in Iran. And that war hero status contributes significantly to his eventually being appointed the head of the Quds Force, which is the foreign expeditionary arm of, Iran's, sort of irregular military called the Republican Guard. So it's
Almighty Republican Guard.
Yeah. These are their elite forces. And unlike Saddam's Republican Guard, these guys actually seem to be somewhat competent. And the Kudzvors certainly, which is sort of the elite of the elite unit in Iran, and it was run personally by Soleimani for 22 years. Not insignificantly, by the way, the guy who replaces Soleimani has been his assistant for 22 years. So I'm pretty sure he's got the playbook on lock, right? I think he's going to continue to run things in much the same way that Soleimani did. I have a fairly high degree of confidence in that evaluation. So he's running the Kudzvors, which effectively means he's running the Republican Guard, by the way, which makes him eventually the second most powerful man in Iran behind the Ayatollah, the Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. This one is Khamenei as opposed to Khomeini, which was the first one. The other thing of note about Soleimani, other than his like sort of mythic status amongst most Iranians, with the exception of there are plenty of Iranian dissidents who hate him and the guard for the things that they have done to sort of suppress rebellion within Iran. And you'll note that we heard members of the dumpster fire administration sort of offering us the same bullshit platitudes that we heard from the Bush administration before the invasion of Iraq, that, you know, these people were hated by the Iranian public. They hated Soleimani. They're celebrating in the streets. And of course, then like millions, literally millions of people show up for the dude's funeral in Tehran, and like the Grand Ayatollah literally weeps over his casket as he like cries for revenge. You know, like, God damn it. When are they going to like, look, just don't embellish. We killed this dude because we wanted to. Don't pretend there aren't going to be consequences. Piss down our back and tell us it's raining. It's ridiculous. So anyway, they've done it again. We heard these same pronouncements from the Trump administration. Turns out the guy is pretty widely loved in Iran. And he is even more loved now that he is a martyr to the great Satan, right? Or has been martyred by the great Satan, which is what happens when you take a guy who's sort of ambivalent at home, but then you go and kill him. Right. It's like, yeah, that's our guy. No, if anybody's going to kill him, it's going to be us. Right. And now that you've done it, we hate you more than we ever hated him. And that's the situation we're now with this guy. But he is a legitimately bad dude. That's the other part of this that makes all of this so difficult. Like, he has legitimately been responsible for the deaths of hundreds of U.S. troops in Iraq over the course of the last, you know, almost 20 years now. On the other hand, just like he helped to ultimately fight the Iran-Iraq war to a stalemate, which was the best that they could kind of hope for under the circumstances, it was Soleimani and the Iranians and the militias that they organized in Syria and Iraq who have done the ground fighting against ISIS, both in Iraq and in Syria. Again, there's some ambivalence because in Syria, those same militias are also propping up Bashar al-Assad, who is a really horrible fucking human being and deserves to be in The Hague briefly and then, you know, have a short drop and a sudden stop. I don't want anyone to make the mistake of thinking I'm sitting over here, you know, somehow like saying it's a bad thing that this dude is dead. He's a horrible person. But it has created a lot of second order consequences that were entirely predictable to everyone except the Trump administration.
Just to make sure that you sound way better than anything I'm going to say, because this can be taken very wrong as well. When I said Kuwait, let's just think about this for a second. Let's say that it's, you know, 98-ish, or even now. I think he's already dead, though. And Norman Schwarzkopf flies into Ontario's airport and gets blown to bits. He is a United States hero, but this guy was a Iranian hero. Like, as long as you're killing people that aren't your people, that's how you become a hero. You become a villain on the other side. So kind of think of what that would do. That would upset a lot of people in the United States. That would also upset a lot of people in Canada.
Yeah, Canada would be super pissed.
Well, guess what? Iraq is super pissed as well now.
Yeah. Iraq, the Iraq situation is also sort of an ambiguous one. It has to be noted up front that the only people who voted, well, so first of all, what they were voting on. Look, U.S. forces are in Iraq right now under a status of forces agreement that basically says we are there by their good graces. Only by their invitation are our troops allowed to remain in Iraq, and are our planes allowed to use Iraq's airspace, which is a pretty significant setback, right, if we get booted out and then end up in a conflict with Iran.
Especially since we're no longer in Syria either.
Yeah. So the prime minister of Iraq, who is... he's a client of Tehran, right? Like, he's an Iraqi Shiite who is beholden to the mullahs, the ayatollahs. The ayatollahs in Iran. Anyway, but nevertheless, he drafts an order that says, get the fuck out. And he sends that to parliament. The only people who voted were the Shiite representatives. The Sunni and the Kurdish representatives stayed away and didn't participate. But it was still 170-0 in favor of us getting the fuck out. So now it's gone back to the prime minister to sign it, which seems a little stupid that he can write the legislation, send it over, and then why does it then have to come back for his signature? He fucking wrote it. Why doesn't he just sign it while it's in front of him? Anyway, it has to go back to him. He has to sign it. He hasn't signed it yet. And that's because the difficulty of getting us out, right, is that Iraq ultimately has very little power with which to force us out if we decided to say no. You know, they could do things like cut off power, order their troops to leave our bases. Most of our force security in Iraq is provided by the Iraqi military, so they could, you know, he could order them to leave and order their mission to end, right? So that they would no longer be training with U.S. forces, which would ultimately mean that we would end up with about 5,000 U.S. troops stranded in the middle of Iraq with no mission, surrounded on all sides by militias that hate them and are going to start lobbing rockets into their compounds. Right. So it's a terrible idea for us to insist on staying and then force their hand that way. But that's the way ultimately it could play out. It's not like the Iraqis are the Iraqi military is going to directly attack the U.S. military.
Imminent threat.
Yeah, that's a funny one.
Evidently there was one. We just don't know what it was yet. Do you think that we will get one? Because I mean, like, is this like a Franz Ferdinand situation?
Wait, what do you mean?
Who is the guy that got shot in World War One?
Oh yeah, yeah. So, international law and domestic law, right? Both say you can't assassinate people. You can't assassinate the leadership of rival countries, unless there is
an imminent... Kill the shit out of every single poor person you see on the way there.
Yeah.
But you can't kill the people on top. I wonder those rules.
No. Let's be clear. That what it means is you can't assassinate them in peacetime. If you've invaded a country and their leadership is actively resisting you, and then yeah, you bomb the fuck out of them, right? But you can't, you know, so we are not at war. Well, effectively, we are at war with Iran now, but we were not at war with Iran. We are not and were not at war with Iraq. We were there by their invitation, and we chose surreptitiously. We didn't provide any notice. For obvious reasons, it would have been really stupid to provide notice to the Iraqis, right? Because we know that they're clients of the Iranians and they would tip Soleimani off. But we didn't provide any notice to anyone else either. There was no notification or briefing for Congress. We didn't provide notice to any of our allies who also have forces in the region that are now threatened by the Iranian retaliation. There are a lot of our allies who are super pissed at us right now because of it. And we assassinated the guy, right? But the euphemism, right, for that little loophole that if you can, you just have to say there was an imminent threat, right? It's the he's coming right at us defense.
Right.
So you have to claim that there was an imminent threat, and then you can call it, get this, you can call it a targeted killing.
Oh, that sounds different.
Yeah, right? Sounds way better. So anyway, we assassinated this Soleimani guy who's not a good dude, but still, assassination is a bad precedent to set. That's why it's fucking illegal. We assassinated this Soleimani guy, and now we have to claim that there was an imminent threat. But we classified all of the details about that imminent threat, and we're never going to declassify them. And according to Pompeo today, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, the details of the imminent threat are irrelevant anyway. No, motherfucker, they're very relevant to those of us who still need to evaluate the legality of what you've done.
From what I understand, there are at least two dead bodies.
Four.
Probably a whole lot more than that. Okay.
Or four.
Only two that were notable.
Yeah. And the other was a guy whose last name is Al-Mahdi, but I can't remember. It's like, it's not Munbir, but it's something similar to that. I would have to look it up. Anyway, he is the head of a coalition of pro-Iranian Shiite militias in Iraq that serve as, you know, sort of an irregular arm of the Iraqi military that's beholden specifically to the Shiite portion of the parliament, which ultimately means they're taking their orders from Iran anyway. And but that guy, we don't have beef with that guy. We're not at war with that guy. But we vaporized him along with Soleimani. You know, whoops.
And two randoms.
And two randoms. Couldn't tell you who the other two are.
Mushrooms.
Yeah.
Remember that from back in the day? Wasn't that what it was? Like the people that accidentally got shot during drive-bys were called mushrooms or something like that?
Really? I don't remember.
I don't know, man. there's all kinds of weird shit that flows around in my head.
Also, by the way, based on the images I saw, those boxes, those coffins in Tehran have got to be empty. I can't imagine what is actually fucking in them. It looked like they hit that convoy with thermobaric weapons, like fuel air devices. Like they make a thermobaric warhead for the Hellfire missiles that they fire from. This was a Mark 9 Reaper, which is sort of the jet-powered version of the Predator drone. Typically, they fire Hellfire missiles, and those Hellfire missiles now have a fuel air warhead, a thermobaric warhead. So it produces an intensely hot detonation. So the frames were glowing cherry red in the images.
Iran took 52 hostages, and President Trump said that he had targets on 52 Iranian places of interest, including cultural places of interest. While Sean and I were trying to figure out when we were going to do this podcast, Sean said, "Oh, by the way, until we do, just, you know, kind of stay away from places that people might want to attack. Just on basic principle, don't be around there, like on New Year's Eve."
Yeah.
Actually, this happened after New Year's, didn't it?
Yeah, but as an example.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't tell everybody, you know, I wasn't like super paranoid. I wasn't like, ah, you have to stay home. It was just like, don't, you know, like, if you were thinking about going out to like a really high-end mall or something like that, bowl game. Yeah, put that trip off a couple of days. Obviously, you can't put the game off, but, you know, skip the game. It's all right. So anyway, yeah, by the way, the Iranian president, a guy named Rouhani, is not also not a fantastic human being, but he had a spicy response. And he said that people who quote the number 52 should also pay heed to the number 290.
Ooh, wait. Can I try to get this one? Can I try to get Go this one?
It. Yeah.
Did we blow up an airliner?
We did. An Iranian
airliner? Okay, yes. Dude, okay, cool, awesome. Well, I mean, definitely not definitely not awesome, but I'm pretty
definitely not
that.
Awesome. It was an Iranian.
Sad for all of them.
Yeah, it was an Iranian commercial airliner flying in Iranian airspace over their territorial waters. And it was shot down by a U.S. Navy ship in a case of mistaken identity. The war was also, if I remember correctly, the war was either just about to end or had just ended when this incident happened. So it happened in 1988. And I can't remember exactly when the announcement took place, whether it was just before or just after. But like, that's how tragically pointless the death of those 290 people were was. Like, so anyway, it was an interesting response from someone who clearly has read, or not read, lived through, right, the actual experience at hand, and someone who, you know, heard someone else say the number 52 around him while he was getting ready to publish his latest tweet from the toilet.
You got anything else on this? Other than that, what should we be keeping an eye out for?
So everybody make sure that you've rotated your passwords. You want a password length of 15 characters or more. The longer, the better. Don't reuse passwords. You know, make sure you've got your cyber shit tight. They will most likely, their retaliation will incorporate both violence in the real world and cyber warfare online. And so it's unlikely that they're going to come after, you know, every American household. But, you know, there's the significant possibility for a number of companies to come under attack along with the government itself online. So that's, you know, we have no idea how effective they might be. It's unlikely that they're going to cause the end of the world with their cyber retaliation, but it's still unlikely to be a whole lot of fun.
Word. Stay tuned. Like I said, subscribe. When the war starts, we'll try to get another podcast in.
Yeah, there you go.
All right.
That means we'll probably be recording tomorrow night.
Oh, shit. Don't say that. So here's another thing that happened when we were over the break, and the story doesn't matter as much as what was behind it. We passed the new NAFTA, or we're on our way to passing the new NAFTA. Went through the House and going to go in the Senate, and hooray, we got the new NAFTA. From what I understand, it takes care of some copyright stuff for like digital stuff that didn't exist when the first NAFTA went through. They equated some amounts of car parts that need to be built in different places, then it has to be $16 minimum wage no matter where cars are being built, and basically the same shit. And So the Democrats got some of the stuff that they wanted. They got some environmental protections and this, that, and the other thing. And the AFL-CIO, the largest union in the country, signed off on it. That's pretty good for the Democrats. Like, and so everybody's happy, and there's Donald Trump and the Democrats all making something good happen. And it happened to be on the same day that impeachment was drawn up. And I have people, I'm reading on the right on my Facebook, my friends, they're like, I can't believe that Donald Trump would do anything with these goddamn Democrats after they, you know, after they are impeaching him. Why would he ever work with them? And I'm like, I mean, that sounds kind of dumb. And then I'm listening to podcasts, and they're talking about how, the Democrats, I can't believe that they would work with him, and that if they could have held out and they could have gotten something better, and why are they giving him a win? And my question is it good policy? Is it good for the American people, like, the way that it is? Or, like, is this the best that we can do? Is this good for America? Or are we just so fucking partisan that when somebody works with the other person, like, it's the worst thing that could fucking happen?
I hate this attitude. Like, it drives me insane. You know, for all appearances, or from all appearances, because I have not read the entire bill, like most of the people who voted on it, it appears to be a modest improvement over the old one. That's a win. Good job, Trump. Good job, Democrats. Good job, Mexico. Good job, Canada. Awesome. Way to go, guys.
Good for us, the American people. Yeah, I mean, we're assuming
It certainly seems that way. Look, you know, there has NAFTA, as imperfect as it was, has driven significant economic growth in all three of our countries since it was enacted. And a modestly improved NAFTA should generate even more. That's a win for the American people.
Hooray!
Hooray!
Okay. You know, it was just something that was really, really fucking bothering me.
Yeah, it makes me crazy. Like, look, yeah, I get it. I understand, like, you're terrified, you know, because you know that the Senate is going to vote to acquit. Like, they're already in the bag for him, although seeing signs that that may start to turn, especially with the announcement of a particular former national security advisor today. But, you know, so the calculus is this. I'm terrified because I know the Senate is already in the bag. They're going to vote to acquit. It means we have to beat him in 2020. He really should have lost in 2016 and still managed to win. And if he wins a second term, there are plenty of these folks who think the world is going to end. Right. If he wins a second term, am I going to be more alarmed about our future than I am now? Oh, yeah, definitely. But it does not mean that the world is going to detonate because he gets elected for a second term. So likewise, that doesn't mean that either side should be cutting off its nose despite its face. Like, this is something that needed to happen. These were improvements that needed to be made to this treaty for all three of our countries to benefit, and they got it done. Good for them. That's awesome. Great. Wonderful. You know, the thing that makes the pettiness on the Democratic side even more abhorrent, right, is that no one's going to fucking remember this when they go to the ballots in November. Like, that's a lifetime away. No one's going to remember that they passed. And they didn't even give it a memorable name, for Christ's sakes. It's the Mexico United States Canada agreement.
So say, sure, man. That's exactly what it is. Some dumb acronym. I mean, not like NAFTA rolls off the tongue, but
yeah, but yeah. It's still better than whatever this would be. I didn't even stop to calculate what the acronym would be because it's just I looked at
Muska,
it. And I was like, that's,
yeah. I think it was like Muscatrin or something like that.
Yeah.
Sounds like it cleans out your nostrils. Yeah. All right. We're going to fucking bring this bad boy to a close. But since you brought it up, you ever like done something and you just have this one goal and you're like, I'm just going to see this one thing through, and then just conditions just turn to shit. And you're like, all right, fuck it. I'm out of here. It could be a party. Could be, I don't know, whatever. And then all of a sudden, as soon as you leave, you find out that fucking thing happens. God damn it. That's why I think that John Bolton is coming out. He's like, this fucking get in a war with Iran shit. This was my whole fucking thing. I held on for as long as I fucking could. I was doing everything I could. I was putting up with all your fucking shit. I wasn't going to fucking testify. I wasn't going to do any of this shit. But no. You got to go fucking try to fucking bomb around. You got to start this fucking shit when I'm sitting over here. Fuck you.
I think that's exactly it. I can't come up with any other reason. Like, the legal justification that his lawyers gave was so flimsy. It really does. And I hate to say it because I don't want that groundswell to build and then he hears it and digs his fucking heels in, because I want the guy to testify. This is great news for everyone, right? It makes it much more difficult for Moscow Mitch to hold out and refuse to call witnesses, because ultimately there already have been three or four senators who clearly are uncomfortable with there being no witnesses. And that's essentially all the Democrats need. They only need 51 votes in order to force the calling of witnesses.
Murkowski and Collins are on the fence. I'm sure we can get good old Mitt to step over.
Yep. And then there was one other I heard someone cite today who was, but I can't remember who it was.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that was a podcast.
Damn right it was.
All right. We. At Plastic Cup Pod, like I said, subscribe, because these things are coming out randomly. So, but here's the thing. This will try to make me edit this shit in a timely manner. We are recording on the 6th of the new year. Hooray, 2020. I am DJing at Prescott Public House this Thursday and every Thursday night, 10 o'clock. Prescott Public House, hip hop, whatever the hell else I feel like. But this Friday, the 10th, I am DJing in Jerome at the Spirit Room. I'm doing a hip hop set in Jerome. What? From 8 o'clock to 11 at the Spirit Room. I'm going to see if I can call out some ghosts with some ghost face killer. You know what I'm saying?
That's awesome.
And then Saturday night, the 11th, this upcoming Saturday, I will be in Cottonwood at State Bar doing like some 80s shit. So that'll be fun. Thank you all very much for listening in. Later.
Later. Whoa!